Good morning and welcome to the WAMC panel for On the Roundtable this morning. It is Wednesday, the 4th of September, and a pleasure to have you with us. We will get the wires situated here in just a second, so Jimmy doesn't look like he is going to be murdered or killed. There you go. There's more. Excellent. poor Jimmy looked very uncomfortable. Joining us for the discussion this morning, WAMC's Alan Chartok, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, and Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind. Good morning, all. How are you?
Very good.
Well, but all tangled up, apparently.
Yes, all tangled up, but we'll take care of that in mere moments. Alan, I didn't hear from you, but I assume you're fine.
I'm just dandy.
Excellent. Try that one, Jimmy. I've given you a little more room. You're okay? You can hear and everything?
All is well.
Okay, good. Welcome to the panel. We have a lot to talk about. Let us begin, of course, with Syria. I thought it was interesting in the fact that yesterday on the front cover of USA Today, there was a kind of a Brady Bunch picture of people, and it said, these are who... This is who is important in this decision, and who the president needs support from, and pretty much everybody yesterday on that list gave their support to the president, and for me that came a lot sooner than I think we expected.
There's also some discussion about whether that support means anything. Boehner, for example, said, yes, I support you, but I'm not going to tell any other Republican to support you, too.
Right. I'm not going to whip my votes.
Yeah. Isn't that the point of being the leader and being in support? What difference does it make if Boehner alone supports him?
And I guess to that, Alan, of if you are, what does that mean about being a leader, isn't that what it's sort of all about? I have my house in order.
Well, he's got a big problem. His big problem is that a lot of his people are facing primaries from the ultra right wingers, and we don't exactly know where they are. So you got two Republican parties now. Up to now, the Republicans in the House have stayed together. But I think this is one, you know, we have an old saying that they're either on the hook, meaning they have to do what he says, or in the tank. And a lot depends on how much problem they have with a potential primary. So what he's trying to do is say, okay, just in case I can't get the votes for this, don't blame me.
Well, and not even that, not even the primary factor, but the ideological factor. There are a lot of members in that Republican conference who were elected in this Tea Party wave, this sort of populist wave. And part of that is not isolationism, but non-interventionism, largely motivated by fiscal issues. You know, look at in our area here, Congressman Chris Gibson, who I spoke to about Syria last week. He's a 24-year Army veteran, so he's got a lot of interesting experience that he brings to bear on this decision. And his point was, we can't really afford this right now. And two, if you bomb Syria, if you do limited airstrikes, which is what seems to be contemplated here in all these resolutions, you're not going to strike a decisive blow by design. Everyone knows that. You're not going to change the facts on the ground. You're going to engender resentment. You may provoke a larger regional response. And so his analysis is that it's going to make things worse.
But he stays off the hook.
But back to the point of Boehner, right? Yeah. You've got a lot of guys in this GOP conference, guys and gals, who are legitimately opposed to this. Boehner has had, how many times in the past 2 years have we seen Boehner try to cut the deal, try to fall in line with the Senate, with the president, only to have his own rank and file revolt at least five times? He can't afford to do that anymore. So on the one hand, by doing what he said with Obama, my read on it is he gains a little chit. All right, I'm doing you a solid, Mr. President. I'm speaking in favor of this. But at the same time, President Obama has to recognize this is his policy. If he wants the votes, he has to whip the votes. And I think it's going to be very interesting this week and early next week to see how exactly and how effectively the president can do that, because there are serious criticisms of the president for not being a legislative meddler a la Lyndon Johnson, who was famous for his ability to bend Congress to his will. You know, the man pushed through the Civil Rights Act, which, you know, as we've read in the biographies, was a massive feat of congressional engineering. President Obama has had a divided Congress for the last 2 years, going on 3 years. And if you look at his legislative agenda, his legislative accomplishments, they're all front-loaded in his term when he had a Democrat-controlled Congress. So this could be a big test for him, and we will see whether or not he rises to the occasion.
Well, let me disagree with a couple of things you've said, Jimmy, because why else are we here? The first of those is that I have interviewed Chris Gibson on this microphones on the Congressional Corner again and again and again. You may have come away with the idea that, his rationale is it's fiscal and we can't afford it. Mine is that this guy, as you said, it was a brigade commander or whatever he was, and he was in the wars and he knew about it, and he said, I don't want to do this.
Well, for the record, I said that it's partly fiscal, partly based on his military analysis.
No, you did, but I just took away some of the emphasis that you had on the fiscal. I think this is a, he's a Republican in the end. He has to support the speaker every year. But on this stuff, I really think he's on the right side. He really understands how dangerous this is for all the reasons that you gave.
So some of what's going on is deciding American policy going forward. Yeah. And I've been doing some interesting reading on by internationals about this, about what Syria represents. It's really historic. We're looking at the continuation of the George Bush administration. For one thing, we're talking about economics with war. We didn't used to do that. We could always afford to intervene whenever we wanted. Now, what was it yesterday? You were counting the cost of each missile we might send into Syria. Sure. That's a result of George Bush cut taxes, run with a permanent deficit. So military operations are now being budgeted, which they never were before.
Yes, but remember, I think you're making that exact point, that when the Bushes ran that second war, it was off budget. Didn't count. Yeah, where was that money coming from?
Crazy. Yeah. But it is the legacy of George Bush that is now making us look at whether we can afford a war. And the second thing is the American policy of we get to decide what weapons you can and can't use. It's okay to shoot at your people and kill them, but you can't use chemicals. Well, or Iran, you cannot have a nuclear weapon, although we have no problem with Israel having it. Same area, same dangers.
Well, the counter argument to that is we are the hegemon, right? We won the Cold War.
Right.
Although that, you could look at the way Russia is now and make counter, but we are the lone superpower in this world. And, to quote the sage words of Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. So by default, if someone is gassing his own people, which it is substantiated that President Assad has, if anyone has to do something, it by default has to be us. And
right.
I have no problem with that.
I think I've been arguing that for a lot of days, although the other side is also very correct. What are we going to do? Just sending it. In fact, even sending in the missiles isn't going to do any good now because we've said what our targets are going to be. Assad's had like how many weeks now to get all of his stuff someplace else? So what value is this at all? It's not whether or not, that's one question though, whether or not we should be the policemen of the world.
Well,
the other one is how we do it effectively.
Right. Well, I think that the argument is that it's the something is less important than the not doing nothing, right? That the point is even if your response, and this is the argument for intervention, that your response, even if it's not a death blow, even if it's not completely effective, just the fact that there is a consequence, that you have demonstrated that there is a tangible consequence.
You're not Neville Chamberlain.
I am not Neville. No one has ever compared me to Neville Chamberlain before, right now. But the fact that there is some consequence for your action, the argument goes, will serve as some future deterrent. Is that true? I don't know.
Now, Jimmy, I have a question for you. Hitler, Alexander the Great, mm-hmm. all these guys, they tried to run the world, right? Now, you just said something which made my ears perk up, which is, if it's not the superpower, then who is it? So we don't have to even be named under the Jimmy thesis. We don't even have to be named the ruler of the world. We just have to have that power to do that under the Jimmy thesis, what you were just saying. If it's not us, who is it? So, in essence, are you saying that we're running the world, or we should be running the world?
Not at all. I'm saying what I'm saying is that it's an increasingly globalized economy. We are the dominant economic player. We are the dominant military player in the world, and as such, a certain leadership role should emerge, right? Let's make the parallel to elementary school, because this is the first day of school for a lot of kids in the region and the state. You know, so if you are the shining example of a good student in the class, you're the bright, you know, athletic, you know, good-looking student.
You should run the class.
No, but you know what? If you see a bully picking on someone who is, for lack of a better word, a pipsqueak, you know, if someone should intervene, why not you?
You are a natural leader. What if you're the bully?
What if you're the bully?
Yeah.
See, the big difference and the big difference.
The handsome ornament student who's the bully.
Then you're a jerk. But my point is, you know, here, there is always American interest at play, and there is, of course, multidimensional chess. But we're not going to war to conquer. We're not going to do these airstrikes to gain territory. We're not going to do these airstrikes to gain resources. We're going to do it to protect, or at least to make a statement about protecting civilians.
I'm not sure you're right. I'm not so sure.
Were those the motives of Alexander the Great, of Adolf Hitler, and of anyone else that you mentioned? And the answer is no, they were not those motives. Those motives were for personal gain. And again, I recognize that there will be some gain to the United States because of the complex interrelations of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But the primary purpose is not self-gain. And therefore, you can't make that calculus.
It's nice that you know that. Eisenhower didn't know it when he talked about the military-industrial complex. Every one of those missiles, as Rosemary just mentioned, may cost $1 million or several million dollars when we get it. Is that full employment for the United States that we're talking about?
Well,
War has been good to the United States. Yeah. It has been. We've gotten rich off of it. We've gotten stronger off of it. What I'm concerned about is, like, bring this conversation back to where we began, decisions about what America's role in the world should be and how to conduct these operations is being made by a handful of people who really are only concerned about whether they're going to get elected in the next 2 to 4 years.
Well, and diplomacy on the front end of actually trying to diffuse some of these issues worldwide before we get to this point.
I'm afraid I may be on Jimmy's side. He just made a face. Go ahead, Jimmy.
No, and you say a handful of people. These are the 435 congressmen and 100 senators that we, the people, elect to be our representatives. So I'd much rather have this situation that, as a citizen, and there are arguments on both sides of this politically, I'd much rather have this situation than the situation in which an executive, several military advisors, and Lord knows who else make these kinds of decisions.
Obama has reserved the right to do that, so we're not out of that.
Right. I like it.
We're going to continue this conversation, but first a short break. We welcome your comments as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this.
Support for WAMC comes from a New Leaf Used Books, Pine Plains, New York, an independent bookstore carrying over 10,000 volumes of fiction, poetry, history, gardening, cookbooks, and more. A New Leaf Used Books on Facebook. Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies, littlewolfarch.com. Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now presenting their Renaissance Robotic System for Minimally Invasive Spine Surgeries with Dr. Ja'an Shen, NLH.org. And Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York, locally owned and operated since 1988, open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 7 days a week, FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. We are talking about Syria this morning, having a spirited conversation, and we welcome you into that conversation as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I just want to move this conversation a little bit further. He stirred some confusion about the potential scope of the American military involvement when he tried to carve out an exception to a proposed congressional prohibition on the use of ground troops in Syria. Right. I do have to say that I was surprised even that when the president was very early on in this conversation, mid to late last week, saying no boots on the ground, no boots on the ground, no boots on the ground, of how much, to me, that is,
no new taxes kind of line, where how can you promise that when you don't know what's going on? And to me, it seemed that it was more responsible, at least for the Secretary of State, to say, well, look, we don't know what's going to happen, so we should never take any option off the table.
To me, Kerry made a mistake that every lawyer warns you against in a deposition. If you're asked a question, you just give the very specific, limited answer. And he, yes, maybe it's more responsible, it's more realistic than the president, but he opened up another whole can of worms, a whole set of worries that if we send in missiles, then it means military forces follow.
But certainly a set of worries that I think everybody was thinking about, and certainly that was, you know, the elephant in the room that we should at some point discuss,
and
right?
And the president also must be thinking that, but he's also realizing that he has to get that first step, and then he'll go in, and if he has to explain why things have changed. He obviously has no problem with flip-flopping on this, on how we're going to conduct this operation.
I mean, the whole issue is that if something happens and Syria falls into complete chaos, and if chemical weapons are going to fall into the hands of a militant group and someone else, then is our option that, okay, we're only going to do missiles, we're not going to go in? And this gets back to the original point of, you know, do we know what we're going to do? Do we know what we're going to accomplish?
Well, we the people don't, but I'm sure that there are more people who are the generals, the military planners have a clear idea. But I think maybe part of this is
right,
the recognition.
But if you're going in and having a congressional debate and there is a prohibition as part of that debate saying that we're not going to put any boots on the ground.
It's not a prohibition. It's what the president said. And all Kerry had to do was say, we just don't anticipate that happening at this time.
Right.
Right.
That's it. I mean, this is talk. This is not military planning going on in front of Congress.
And the other thing is, it just seems in this era of special forces where we've seen that our most robust military capabilities in Afghanistan have been wedding small special forces units to high-level intelligence. That's where the most of our strikes have come. Do we really think there will be no single boot on the ground? And even if Congress explicitly prohibits it, do you really think there will be no boots on
yeah,
the
well,
ground?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, they're there already. We know the CIA is there.
Well,
right?
Of course,
so
right?
In great numbers. So.
You're telling me that there's not going to be a guy with a laser guiding those bombs or those missiles?
No, to me, the big issue in this thing, maybe I'm diverting the conversation, is Putin. I mean, you have to get inside Putin's head to understand what it is. There was, as I was coming in at 3 o'clock this morning or 3:30, whatever it was, and I was listening to the BBC, and there was an item on there about, it didn't say Putin blinked, but it said Putin almost blinked. And he said, well, there's got to be a solution to this. Something is operating on him so that he has a sense that somehow he doesn't want to seem, first of all, what happens if we do go in and you know, we mess up his idea that his thumb is in our eye and somehow we do it? And where does that leave him? So it makes him want to do something that seems like he may make a deal. And that, to me, is where this sort of thing comes down to.
He says that he has not ruled out backing a U.S.-led military operation in Syria if the Kremlin gets concrete proof that an alleged chemical attack on civilians was committed by Assad's government.
Isn't it a classic case of, if you're Vladimir Putin, why would you surrender immediately, right? Why wouldn't you extract some price?
Well, you've got 50.
If the United States of America and the major other powers want a UN authorization, and you could say yes, or you could say yes and get something.
Well,
right?
You know, he's got 50,000. Right. He's got 50,000 people over there. That's what I read in the Times, I guess.
In Syria,
and up to $5 billion worth of contracts. So
yeah,
okay. So. It's a question of money.
So
okay.
To preserve
can't
it.
Find
yeah.
that some way. There can't be some other interest that
he
could be
is not
meddled.
Gonna, he's not going to agree to regime change. I really don't believe that. But I do believe there may be you can't use chemical weapons anymore kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I heard those comments. And, you know, it's not someone who follows the nitty-gritty of international politics, but who understands politics, I think, you know, he's leaving himself open to some sort of negotiated, either publicly or incredibly quietly.
Because he fears
deal.
Being a loser. He fears somehow he's going to end up on the wrong side of this thing, either internationally in terms of opinion or in terms of the outcome of what goes on in Syria.
Right.
So many people now are looking at what would you do if you were Assad right now? And here's what you do. You just keep fighting the war you have and don't use don't use chemicals anymore. That caused a whole lot of problems. You already made your point. Just keep fighting, and you're going to win. He has a huge army. It's one of the biggest armies in the world, which I don't think I fully realized. But thanks to Putin and China, Putin and Iran, he has a huge, huge, powerful army. It competes with Israel. So he's going to win this. All he has to do is just keep us at bay a little bit longer.
I want to talk a little bit about the president's trip. He is now in Stockholm. He will be making his way tomorrow to Russia and the G20 summit. We'll talk about that and its impact on this issue of Syria and much more when we return. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, and we have a great panel before us this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind, all before us. Good morning to all, and we welcome your comments, your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org. John writes in and says, I do not support the president in his mindless quest to bomb Syria. There still is no conclusive proof that Assad regime did in fact use chemical weapons on his people. There are even reports that chemical weapons have been used by the opposition. What moral authority does this man in the White House have, given our own misdeeds in the world, such as torture, use of weapons of mass destruction, assassinations, even of our own citizens, etc.? Attacking any sovereign country who is not a threat to our security is aggression by an empire who wants to control the region and its oil. Your guests who support this action are defending not the rule of law, but empire. Do any of those who are supporting empire want to comment?
No.
No.
Okay, excellent.
Well, I did mention something.
All right, Alan.
Like yeah. No, I just did mention something like that, you know, the idea that we could be, if not the official head of the world, the sort of unofficial head of the world. And that's what
I think John's comments would have greater weight if we were invading. I mean, I made the point that this is a strike that doesn't seem to be motivated primarily by self-gain. It's certainly not being sold that way. And I don't see clear and direct methods in which it will provide self-gain. So I disagree with his point.
Also, Beth writes and says, don't worry, we are going but backwards. It's soldiers first, then bombs. But if they bomb first, there are no credible witnesses to the deaths on the ground. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We're going to move on to other issues and talk about other things going on. And let's take on the juicy issue that's always with us in some way, shape, or form, lawmaker pay.
Lawmaker pay. There was an interesting report released released.
Yeah,
yesterday.
You wrote it.
You wrote about it.
I wrote about it in today's edition of the Times Union. And essentially, lawmakers for the first time this year had to disclose how much they're paid for all their outside work. So
once again, let me correct you or try to.
Please, please. They
did their usual nonsense when they made this law of leaving between this amount and that amount.
Right.
So we don't know exactly how much they make.
Yeah. Right. We don't know exactly how much they make. We know within some pretty reasonable bands. Mm-hmm. And so we have pretty reasonable estimates of what people have. It's not the exact dollar amount that Dr. Chartok points out. But
one wonders why they didn't do it the right way and just said, here's what we made last year.
You know, I can't speak to that. But so we have this disclosure of these ranges of lawmaker pay. And this happened for the first time this year. And two good government groups, as well as a sort of journalism center called the New York World. It's based at the Columbia Journalism School. They analyzed the data. They created a database and essentially took the way the state discloses things, which is kind of clunky. They put up a bunch of PDF forms and blah, 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 blah. You have to go through them and made it very user-friendly and then did some analysis. One of the more interesting points that I found in the analysis was they looked at when you account for a state lawmaker's base salary, which is $79,500, the stipends they get for chairing a committee or for holding a leadership in the legislative conference, what they make from outside jobs, what their spouse, if they're married, makes from an outside job. And they came up with a range of potential household income for a state legislator. And the median value was three times the median value for the average New York family, as reported by the Census Bureau. Something like 171 was the top end of the estimate, because as you point out, there was a range. And the median for a family is around just shy of $57,000. So, you know, there had been talk of a pay raise for state legislators at the Capitol. It sort of evaporated last year when Superstorm Sandy hit and when the response to that, you know, muscled its way into the political discussion. And over this past legislative session, where we've seen lawmakers indicted, lawmakers arrested, and we've seen Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, who had been one of the principal advocates for a pay raise, dogged by scandal, it has sort of evaporated now. But this report, you know, I think very interesting, and this database is going to be informative in political discussions going forward, because as Bill Mahoney, NYPERG's research coordinator, argues, it's going to let people in the public see if their legislator is being paid by some outside concern, if their legislator holds some investment that is perhaps affected by a measure that they're voting on. So,
Are there two issues that you're raising here? One is who the money comes from,
right,
which is definitely a public interest, and I love that. The other is how much should a lawmaker make? And we're not just talking about their salary. We're talking about what other income we allow them to get.
Right.
And how much should they get? Should they make? Should they be allowed to make? Do we want them to make three times as much as us regular people?
Well, you know, you have to look. Most of these people are college educated, so that would skew things in terms of the median number. Many of them have advanced degrees. There are a lot of lawyers.
Right.
And many argue that by taking these jobs as legislators, their earning power is cut. And for some of them, that is certainly true. Some of the wealthiest people in the chamber, in the state Senate, John DeFrancisco and John Bonasek, Republicans, they are successful attorneys. They made a lot of money as lawyers, and they make some money as lawyers now, but it's not nearly what they could be making if they were just doing that. And the argument for someone like that is that they are essentially lending their expertise and their life experience to the public purpose by serving and by legislating, by writing and considering and tweaking laws. But, you know, the flip argument is by paying lawmakers what we pay them, you can get, for lack of a better word, some bottom feeders, people who will get in and this is all that they'll do, and they won't really do a good job of it. And there are other states where the pay is quite low. New Hampshire, I think it's less than $10,000 lawmakers are paid. And the argument for that is, If you pay them less, they're not going to want to be there. They're not going to do this full time. They're going to want to get things done, and you're going to attract the type of person who wants to get things done. You know, the school board model, which was my first exposure to public and elective service, was, you know, you go there, it's free coffee, you know, usually there are cookies, and you get a barbecue once a year. But really, you know, you're dealing with a lot of grief, usually, and you have a lot of responsibility, but you're doing it because you, as someone who runs and wins the office, want to do something. You want to serve and make these decisions for the better good. You're not really gaining anything out of it personally.
Well, you know, I've been around for a long time watching these.
How many years, Alan?
A long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I showed up here in the 1960s for the first time, and I've been watching this. Look, Let's be honest about it. You know, you have a choice of going to lawyer A or lawyer B, and you have a choice of you got a lawyer A who's in the state legislature, and you got or lawyer B, and often you got a lawyer A because you think there may be ancillary benefits, you know, for doing that. I'm always fascinated by the argument over spouses, husbands or wives, mm-hmm. Because you know we have to assume that people are allowed to, you know, to make a living on their own without being held accountable because they're a wife or a husband of somebody. On the other hand, it's a great way of funneling money into the family, you know, by just simply saying, okay, I'm going to the senator's wife, you know, and then he'll do what I want. This business over how much money they make is so fascinating. There are so many things to worry about in the state legislature, and we inevitably focus on what we can understand, which is how much money they're making.
Right, and it is a bit voyeuristic.
I wanted to ask one more thing, and that's also hinted at in what you wrote about today, which are the system of fees that are set up. Aside from salary, there's this system that you get extra money to chair.
The Lulus.
the Lulus, and that to me seems interestingly. We did a story in Bosnia on this very thing: what members of parliament were paid, and it was exactly these fees: how much an allowance they got for driving, how much an allowance of they got for running a committee, and there was tons of abuse in there. And that bothers me far more than legislators making a lot of money.
And there are people who say that that system should be abolished, especially right. because those titles, and there are a lot of titles that they're I'll say it. They're just titles.
I think the legislature.
Assistant conference leader. What does that even mean?
Yeah, yeah. You know? When I worked for the New York State, when I worked for the Eagleton Institute of Politics, we had a study of that. And I think New York was the number one titled place so that everybody right. could get some money.
But the flip side is, you know, legislators, rank and file legislators, they have to be in session for roughly 6 months of the year. And then their work is done. But if you're the legislative leader, if you're the speaker, if you're a majority leader, you're acting year-round, and you're acting in that responsibility year-round. And there's, I think there's probably a really good argument to be made for giving extra compensation for that extra work. Some of the committee chairs, if you chair a committee, right now, today, actually, in 15 minutes, there will be a hearing of the state Senate's finance committee to talk about tax policy. So the chairs of those committees get an extra stipend. And I think that's
reasonable.
I think
a car. They used to get a car. I don't know if they still
do. Some do get cars. Some still do get cars.
I mean, it's not to say that these extra pieces of money are all unreasonable.
But right.
What happens is they get into place and then they become more and more unreasonable and unchecked over time.
And they become carrots and sticks.
Exactly.
Oh, Legislator Armeo, you're not going to vote with me? Well, so much for your $10,000
down to the basement.
Stipend.
I'm pretty sure she's not going to vote with
down
you.
Down to the basement.
Oh, I read
on principle.
I read a story this morning and said, man, I'm in the wrong line of business. By the way, the New York Times has an article about how men are deeply affected, like real psychological damage when their spouse does better than them. Even if they're not in the same field and they're not directly competitive, it sets up a great fear reaction.
So I
don't know what this does for our legislators.
Yeah. I'd love that.
I don't get it.
What?
Wouldn't you like a spouse who could bring in a
Well, I think Joe's saying that. I think Joe's
Well, I don't, like, I don't get why that would bother him. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't. We could talk about that at another time. We have all kinds of stuff to talk about. We'll do so right after a quick break, and we'll answer a couple more letters as well. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield. Offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs, stevelewissubaru.com. Ophthalmic Consultants of the Capital Region, ophthalmologist Dr. Asher Weiner, glaucoma specialist performing minimally invasive glaucoma, laser, and cataract surgery, ophthalmicconsultants.com. Taste of New Paltz, 23rd Annual Fall Food and Beer Festival, offering fare from regional restaurants, wineries, farm markets, and craft beer, Sunday, September 15th, Ulster County Fairgrounds, newpaltzchamber.org, or on Facebook. And Maria College, Albany, offering RN Baccalaureate Completion Program, Associate Degrees and Professional Certificate Programs, day, evening, weekend, and online classes, aspire, achieve, become, mariacollege.edu.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel, Rosemary Armeo, Jimmy Vielkind, and Alan Chartok. We welcome your comments. We got this comment from Robert, who writes, a Tomahawk cruise missile costs $1.4 million, and we will fire over 200 of them at Syria, says Robert. Who is paying for this? Will the Federal Reserve just print money, or will we be paying more taxes? We spent $600 million on Libya. We've certainly brought up that point.
Third
Who
choice.
Pays for this? Yes.
Third choice, or will we take from pre-K in order to pay for the missiles?
Yes.
Or
whatever other important program that happens to come down the line. Paul writes a lengthy note, and I will just take one paragraph out of it, which says, Syria has not attacked us or our allies. This is civil war. We should stay out of civil wars in general, however bloody. While we should never approve or tolerate the use of gas in the sense of winking at it, as we apparently did in the Iraq-Iran war, it is not our job to enforce the treaty banning chemical weapons single-handedly. That should be done jointly, internationally, inevitably, through the UN.
Oh, good letter.
And we thank you for your notes and welcome you at roundtable@wamc.org. Let's move on to probably our final topic for this morning. And do you want to talk about racial slur suit, or would you like to talk about budget battles?
Boy, they're both good. Let's do them fast and do both of them.
Okay, so the story out of, I found this story to be fascinating. A New York City jury has awarded $30,000 in punitive damages against a black employer who used a racial slur against a black employee. The sum is in addition to the $250,000 of compensatory damages awarded last week to Brandy Johnson, 38 years old, for the March 2012 rant by her boss. Employment agency founder Rob Carmona, 61 years old, had argued his use of the N-word was a term of love and endearment. The case heard debate on the use of the slur by black and white people. The Manhattan federal jury decided on Tuesday that Mr. Carmona must pay $25,000 and his organization must pay another $5,000.
I point out that this is an all-white panel discussing this issue.
Yes.
That's one thing. But what he said was unacceptable. The terms are almost secondary to the message that he was giving. He was harassing a woman. She had said to him, please don't use that word with me. And he did it anyway. He did it again. He used his term of love and endearment. So he's clearly at fault, it seems to me. And I think that figures into the payment he was ordered to make.
I think you make a great point, because the press has picked up this as simply a matter of about the N-word as opposed to the verbal abuse and her repeated complaints about that very issue.
The case is also interesting to me because it points out that behavior in the office is separate from the work that your company does. This employment office that he runs has done remarkable things for black women. It has put many of them to work, and the articles have pointed that out. But that doesn't give you a buy to treat people like crap in your own office.
And obviously this makes news because he is African American, the employee was African American, and that was sort of the crux of this. And then where things start to go off the rails is when you say that this is to convey that Ms. Johnson was too emotional, wrapped up in her at least the negative aspects of human nature.
Yeah, see, like I'm switching from race discrimination or harassment to sexual harassment. That's just unacceptable.
An interesting story indeed.
Ooh, I get the final word? Cool.
Unless anybody else wants to chime in, I think you're it, though, Rosemary. You and me. That's it. And then let us talk about the budget battles that are going on. While certainly we are, it seems to be, at momentarily have blinders on and looking at the run-up to a potential war in Syria. Meanwhile, where is the money coming from? The collision of the $1 trillion in budget cuts known as the sequester and the breakdown of the normal budgeting process is creating headaches, not just for Washington, but also for a vast web of offices dependent on federal financing. Many have been left uncertain as to how much money, if any, they will have to spend in the year ahead. So this is very reminiscent of the schools around budget time in the state who say, okay, we're supposed to be planning our budgets are going out, but how much money are we actually going to get from the state?
It seems to me that the question here is, how outraged are the voters? In other words, are they really...
I never feel they're outraged enough.
Well, that's the implication of the question. In other words, there are these various agencies saying quite properly, we don't know how we're going to operate, and this kid isn't going to get what the kid deserves and the rest of it. But there's an incredible quiet on the part of the American voter or the American citizen who are not cumulatively angry about what these governmental groups are giving out or getting. And they're just it seems to me that that's all that is needed to perpetuate it.
Yeah, I think part of that is it's the federal budget is not an easy thing to wrap your head around. And it's actually much harder from where I sit than the state budget is to wrap your head around. The state budget seems relatively straightforward. We spend this. And the state actually adopts a full budget. The federal budget is done in pieces. You have a transportation bill. You have a farm bill, which has some levels. And there's just sort of this hodgepodge of funding for different programs that happen at different times at different places. And so I think that it's very easy for an elected official or a president or whatever to kind of distract and break it down on certain issues, and it's very easy for a voter to get lost.
But to Alan's point, if you have a researcher, as this article in the New York Times quotes, if you have a cancer researcher in Baltimore who is saying what people should know is less science is being done, that means cures for cancer will not emerge. Cures will not emerge as a direct result of what is happening. And to Alan's point, so where is the outrage over that? Because we can certainly, yes, I agree, it's very complicated, it's very piecemeal, but still, cause and effect.
Well, we can see that. We can also see when my kid doesn't get into pre-K because the slots got cut. We can see when my Social Security check doesn't come because they're delayed and there's no money for that. But generally, you can't see these tangible consequences. And it's good journalism that they're finding this cancer researcher to talk about the tangible effects of these budget battles. But if you think about it, public attention is only drawn to this when there's the specter of a government shutdown. And the other thing that I think plays into it, Joe, is that we had the sequester and there were going to be predictions of, you know, furloughed employees running in the streets and just problems, blah, blah, blah. And here we are. How many months later?
And my world
has not collapsed.
That's right.
Yeah, but I guess it's the term of what collapse is. You know, I guess it depends on where collapse is, because certainly things are not running the way they should. Things are not.
But has you felt a tangible effect on your life because of the sequester?
Well, I mean, it depends on tangible. You can certainly see it. I think
you have not been inconvenienced.
Yeah.
No.
You have. I mean, I travel a lot. I'm not even held up in lines.
No,
I was expecting
absolutely.
That. So that's
absolutely.
What I think we're concentrating on the public's reaction, which ought to be stronger. But how about the sense of shame among the legislators who are not doing a basic job?
Yeah.
They are not doing their job. This whole sequester was set up as a kind of a dare. You know,
right.
we'll make the deadline or else this will go in and no one wants this. And it's in effect. And now they're talking about extending it, about deepening the cuts. Horrendous. Not the way to cut, even if you're totally in favor of cutting the budget. You don't do it this way, just lopping off things willy-nilly. It's bad job.
We were talking before, Jimmy wrote an excellent article on legislative salaries. Well, I believe that in the Senate, I think every single member of the Senate is more than a millionaire. I think everybody in the Senate.
The U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate. Right. And so their experience with, you know, the effect of budget cuts is not exactly the same as somebody who is going to get fewer food stamps this year.
Right.
And can't feed their kids.
Right. And you know, it goes to Rosemary's point. You know, we for the past several years, we've seen the basic narrative from Washington. I think we've discussed this before in this room has been, they didn't do it. They didn't solve the problem. Here's the problem. Here's the big run for the problem. And there's some sort of half solution, but there's never a real solution. And I think that's what we've seen dropping or has prompted the precipitous fall in congressional approval ratings to all-time lows.
Sure, but the Republicans have learned a lesson. Under Newt Gingrich, they learned a lesson. You can't shut down the government.
We are out of time, but I thank everyone for participating. We'd love your letters as well. Roundtable@wamc.org. Alan, Rosemary, Jimmy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Pleasure.
All right. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.